Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo at earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all our past programs at radioinvivo.net. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Hamner for its support. And Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology, by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And last but not least, Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. Well, this week on Radio In Vivo, we are going to venture into the world of music, or more specifically, music recording technology. And we are doing so because there is a fantastically innovative company in Raleigh called Zempf Studios that has been receiving worldwide attention for their proprietary technology that allows the so-called reperformance of classic live music musical performances from the past with today's pristine recording and listening quality. Dr. John Q. Walker is president and co-founder of this company called Zempf Studios. He received his PhD in software engineering from UNC Chapel Hill and has been involved in several other high-tech enterprises here in the Triangle area. He also has a bachelor's degree in music and mathematics, a master's degree in computer science, and also pursued master's level work in music performance at the University of Illinois. John, thanks so much for joining us on Radio In Vivo today to tell us all about the remarkable work you guys have been doing.
You're welcome, Ernie. Glad to be here.
Well, given the brief academic resume I just gave for you.
It sounded pretty long to me.
Yeah, it sounded quite accomplished. It really sounds like this company is the culmination of all your interests.
Yeah, it's a good match for my background. I had a good long career at IBM, and then we were able to do a nice startup in prime time about 10 years ago. And as we rolled off to that, we looked at what would be the next thing to work on, and it looked like there was an immense unsolved problem in the area of music and reproduction.
I see. Well, I'll tell you, I've been really looking forward to our conversation today. If nothing else, because for the first time ever on Radio In Vivo, I get to play DJ and share some terrific music with our listeners. But before we spin a platter or two, why don't you give us just a brief overview of Zempf Studios, how you got started, and exactly what it is that you do.
All right. We are a software company, and what we do is we take recordings, and we figure out exactly how every single note was played, you know, kind of the microsecond it was touched and how fingers were pressed down and, you know, if it's the piano, where the pedals were and all these kinds of things, and represent all of that knowledge as computer data and then play it back again in a very sophisticated software and robotics. And the sense is that you're in the room with the musician exactly as they were playing the day it was recorded.
even if they've been long gone from the planet.
And we will go through some many examples here, I think, this morning.
Yes, indeed. Well, John, yeah, I think the best way to give our listeners a feel for this amazing work is going to be to hear some of it. So I'd like to start out by playing your brief before and after sample. This is the quarto, so tell us what we're going to hear with these cuts.
All right, this is a piano recording that was made in 1926, and if you kind of know your history recording, that's one of the first years that where they had electric microphones. Before that, it was acoustic horns. So actually, this is a pretty good recording for the time in 1926. What you're going to hear is the digitally remastered version, so this is the best that technology can do in this time. The pianist was one who played spectacularly well, but as he aged, he didn't age well in terms of his playing. But as you think about recording, the older he got, the recording techniques got better. So his later recordings sound better than this early one, but his playing wasn't quite so good.
I see. Okay.
And it's a kind of a playing. It's a style. It's very romantic that people don't hear much anymore. And again, it's because you have to go back 80 or 100 years to hear this kind of playing.
And it's a piece of Chopin?
It's a little piece of Chopin. It's a Chopin prelude. It's just less than a minute long. It's the third one.
Okay, and this is track two mm-hmm. on the CD, and this is going to be the 1926. This is the before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's the recording from 1926. Obviously a masterful performance, but the track itself was almost painful to listen to. I can't imagine anyone but a musicologist subjecting themselves to that. So in essence, that performance would be lost to modern audience. And now let's hear the after version after the application of your technology. John, that is just amazing, and we should be clear here. This is much, much more than just simply a process of cleaning up existing audio. This is literally precisely recreating the actual performance itself in all of its subtleties and nuances and even idiosyncrasies, and even the performance space itself. So I'd like to hear more detail about the different steps involved. Why don't you tell us how it starts? Let's say you've selected a particular performance you want to recreate. What happens then?
All right. So obviously one of the first steps is to get it into the computer. So you kind of run the analysis and get it onto a hard drive. Mm-hmm. And then we go through a process where we discover everything that might be a note. And everything that might be a note are, of course, the notes themselves. But also there is kind of reflections off the walls, or there's harmonics from other strings, or there's all kinds of the artifacts of, was that a note or not? And we kind of go through this process of deciding, you know, here's the collection of everything there might be. And in this particular recording, there was probably, you know, 1,500, 2,000 notes that were played. And so we kind of do this discovery for every one of them.
That's a very painstaking process.
It is. The whole process, as I'm going to describe it, is kind of a, you know, a step-by-step refinement. And everything that we're doing is using software we've essentially written ourselves in this very high-resolution format so that we can get all the touch and the nuance. But we still have humans in the process. And the best way to describe it is if you think about what Pixar does when they create a new movie, a Toy Story or Cars or something, they've written all their own software to generate the various different aspects of the computer graphics, but they still need human animators to put this all together. And so we've got human animators ourselves in here to assure that we're kind of doing a lot of the steps right. What I talked about first was discovering all the notes, and we'll kind of go in that in a bit more detail, because once we discover them, then we have to go through the process and say, what are they? You know, is this thing that I'm looking at the computer, is this a D sharp? And how was it touched, and how was it played, and how long was it held, and were the pedals down, and all those kinds of things.
Sure.
And then we have to give numbers to all that, I hate to say. But, you know, there's 1,000 different ways that you can touch a note, and 1,000 different, you know, gradations that we can get to in this process.
Have you been able to automate any of that part of the process?
Yeah, a lot of this is automated, but then people ask me, well, then how long does it take? Well, all the automated steps take 1 second.
Right.
Because the computers keep getting faster. So, again, it's kind of, you know, there are obviously humans involved in this.
So you're sitting there looking at a waveform, a digital waveform of the original.
And then various representations of the waveform. So we look at, you know, Fourier transforms. And we have different ways. And, you know, on a screen, there'll be many different ways to show what's happening back in the audio. And then I hate to say that there's another whole category of things we have to deal with. Which is information about the original recording. Where were the microphones originally? Where was the piano positioned in the room or some other kind of instrument? And all of those play into decisions of how loud, what was the real dynamic range on the original recording? Because all you're hearing is this artifact that has a very compressed dynamic range compared to a real instrument. And we have to do all those mappings from the data in the recording.
Sure. And
did that get too technical?
No, not okay, a bit. Good. This is a science show. You can get as technical as you want. That's what we're here for. So how do you deal with anomalies in the original recording? I know that in the Glenn Gould we're going to be hearing in a couple of minutes, you identified that there was a splice in the original recording. How do you deal with that?
The splice is an interesting one that I never anticipated, so I'm glad you brought that up. In this opening aria of the Gould, about 8 measures from the end, there's a spot where clearly they took 2 takes and stuck them together, you know, with a splice. What happens when you do that is the first part of the take up till the splice is in one tempo, and then right after the splice, it's in a slightly different, but, you know, it's just kind of imperceptibly. It could be 0.1% difference. But nonetheless, no human, in a way, can play perfectly in one tempo and then at a line change their tempo.
Sure.
I never heard this. None of us heard this in the original recording. There isn't a tick or anything that identifies the splice. But when we had done our work and put it on a real live concert grand instrument, and the instrument was playing this back, when the splice, when you hear this, when you hear the instrument go through this momentary tempo transition, your brain registers the fact that it's not human. God, there's layers of what it means to be human or not in here. But you realize that no musician can spontaneously and at exactly change their tempo at a point.
Nor would they want to. So
our recording engineer has jumped in here because this is such an interesting topic. And we realized this is what had happened, that there was a splice there. But I never identified it till I heard the live instrument in the room playing it. Never heard it on the recording.
Wow.
So then we had the decision that says, what are we going to do about this? Are we going to make a gradual transition? Are we going to keep this just like it is? And what we had decided to do with the Gould album is we matched, you can play the original recording and our new one on Sony, you can play them simultaneously, the whole CD front to end. So we said, we're not going to change it. We're going to preserve it just like it is.
Sure.
And if you happen to be in the room and hear one of these live re-performances, you're able to detect that. And there's all kinds of other little problems where people are obviously were gain writing, mm-hmm. you know, playing mm-hmm. with the volume controls, and we had to decide in all these kind of cases what we're going to do.
Right. Well, once you have the first part of the process taken care of and the waveform mm-hmm. where you want it to be mm-hmm. and all cleaned up with all the algorithms
yep.
you apply,
we have to
what happens then?
We have to represent it in a computer data form. And that you may have heard the term MIDI, which stands for Musical Instrument Digital Interface.
Right.
And that was a standard for doing computer music that came out about 1980. Well, gosh, what computer standard do you use that's 27 years old still today, right?
Absolutely.
and I got to say, in original MIDI, there just aren't enough bits. And the timing isn't quite precise enough and so on to be able to represent this touch and nuance and to literally cross this line that says it sounds human. We were blessed with the fact that Yamaha in Japan also realized the same problem
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and created the level of, you know, hardware and robotics and so on that for a new high-res MIDI, so we get many more bits. And we get the ability to get to the touch, and we get to very precise timing, and we get, you know, tricks like silent notes and how they're touched and all these kinds of things as well.
I see. So it's really that upgrade to the MIDI standard.
Yes.
That's the key to being able to recreate the performance.
Probably a good way to describe this is we're a software company. I'm a dumb software guy. Like you said, I got my degree here at Chapel Hill in software. And we had to wait till the hardware got good enough in order to be able to do the software that made any sense. You know, if we just had player piano technology, it would always sound like, no matter what we did, it would still sound like a player piano. So we had to cross this line in terms of sophistication.
And that is the important line in terms of allowing this automated playback to sound
That's right.
human.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It still turns out that the automated playback is one where what our business is, you know, we have a contract with Sony that we're doing new albums for them.
Right.
And, we just have to get it right once at the recording session. But when we get it right once, that means that the piano has to be in perfect regulation and mm-hmm. perfect calibration. You know, if you think about every hammer on the piano, we have to be able to get 1,000 levels of degree out of every hammer. And then all 88 have to match uniformly across the entire instrument. And if any one kind of slightly goes out, then we stop the recording session and adjust the piano. And
I'd hate to be the tuner.
Correct. So we actually use it. We fly a tuner in from New York who's mm-hmm. specific to our work, and he's worked with us for about 5 years.
I see.
And we look at this, we say, in a recording session, every time we run into a problem, there's three different ways we can fix it. One of them is we can change the hammer. It's called the voicing. You know, you play with the
sure.
felt on the hammer.
Mm-hmm.
And
with pins and...
Yeah, various. Right. Yeah, so you can change that. Or you can change the regulation, which is the way the action strike. Or we can change the software. So we can go back to the code and say, wait a minute, strike this a different way in this particular case. But then, of course, you got to make sure it matches everything.
I see. That is amazing. Tell us a little bit more about the instrument itself. It's a Yamaha Disc Clavier Pro?
Yeah, it's called Disc Clavier Pro.
And it's a very high-tech instrument.
Well, again, this is it's not maybe the normal Disc Clavier you'd see down at the shopping mall or something. That this is, mm-hmm. you know, professional grade as opposed to kind of consumer grade.
Sure.
And it's like HDTV compared to regular TV. They just built in a lot more bits and capability, and that's what allows us to get to the nuance. It's hard to encounter them in real life. It's you kind of got to make a good order to Japan to get one.
I imagine so. Well, I would imagine there's not a huge demand for them.
Well, that's right.
Yet.
Well, I think there should be, but step at a time.
Well, that leads me to my next question. Actually, the higher MIDI standard that you have developed, would you envision at some point licensing that particular technology so that it might eventually become the new industry standard? I mean, we're all moving eventually to high definition TV, as you pointed out. Is that kind of thing a part of your business
model? So this is a very good question. Again, what we're doing is in our software for this instrument, we've recreated the spec from Yamaha. Well, it's kind of a funny twist on things here that I'm making an odd generalization, but it's one of these where Japanese technology culture is really good at building kind of sophisticated hardware and, you know, micro nuances of all these things. but there was no hardware, no software spec.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we spent the better part of a year, in a way, reverse engineering the instrument to figure out how we were going to get all these effects, because we could see that they were possible, and we've kind of built a spec. So it's Yamaha's spec, but again, we've implemented that in our own software. Your question about business model was the one that says, what we'd like to see is that become then a plug-in into Pro Tools or Cubase or some of these commercial sequencers that, again, now only look at regular resolution MIDI. To do this, they're going to have to deal with some of the, you know, the new things that are available, but I think that's a step-at-a-time process. It makes sense.
I see. Well, you know, this can obviously also be done as a live performance, or as you're doing, re-recording the original performances to bring them into the 21st century. So when you are in the recording process, is the instrument patched in directly to the recording equipment and processed further, or do you actually have it playing in a live space and use microphones?
Live space with microphones.
Is that right?
It's
okay.
Unbelievable, in fact.
I don't believe it.
Yes. Okay.
And before we go any further, I should introduce John Paul McClellan, who is running board for me today.
If so you got 5 minutes. Yeah. So let me talk to you a little bit, because we just did a new recording. And,
okay.
Looking on our list here, it's not going to be the next thing up, but let's talk about it anyway.
Sure.
What we did was recorded a new Art Tatum album that he had recorded in the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles in 1949. Now, Shrine Auditorium is the biggest hall in North America, seats 6,300 people. And it was one of the few live concerts they recorded of him. Mostly it was in a bar or in a studio or something. So this was literally a live setting with an audience and applause and all these kinds of things. So we did the same thing. We went and rented the Shrine. We got Sony's best recording engineers. I mean, obviously, this is their project.
Mm-hmm.
We got an audience, and we put the piano on stage, and we set up the microphones for surround sound and for headphone recording, and I'll talk about that in a minute.
Right.
And we had an MC, and they said, here's Art Tatum. And here's Art Tatum playing, you know, How High the Moon and Humoresque and Gershwin Medley and so on. Now, let me tell it to you from our point of view. We've talked about the fact that we've built a very controlled lab in Raleigh to mm-hmm. be able to do this work, and it's temperature and humidity control, because we need to control environment. Well, we'd spent several months coding up the software for Tatum. It never sounded quite right in our hall. In fact, the best place was always outside of the hall with the door open. You'd be out there and you go, oh, Tatum sounds great. But you walk in the hall and it was just too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's in a way playing too big, and he's, you know, it's a certain style playing, and it's an uncomfortable feeling. And I was like, oh my God, we're about to go in a recording, Sony recording session, and it doesn't sound quite right.
Mm-hmm. Because he was playing for the hall.
Well,
it was ambience.
Right. So let me tell you, that Sunday morning, the piano's on the sweet spot on the stage in the Shrine.
Wow.
And we put in the software to play the very first one, and it's the Humoresque thing, the very famous Tatum piece. And every rest, every beat, every accent, every slur was made for that room. And we had the instrument and the player back in the room again. And I just stood there and cried. It was an unbelievable experience to be able to hear Art Tatum live in the room where he had recorded this.
Sure, absolutely.
So
you're
it is
channeling Art Tatum.
That's right. So again, the improvement was, it was, you know, in 1949, a mono mic, you know, probably real deck and whatever. And it had all kinds of problems with the tape that we fixed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And now we've got the latest high definition surround sound where it's on super audio CD, or it plays on regular CD. And then lastly, we did this one more step, and it's called a binaural recording. And I don't know if you've heard of this, but it's like the microphones are in something that looks like a wig head or a wig holder.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the microphones are where the ears are. And we put this thing where Tatum's head would be as he played. And when you listen to this now in headphones, not in speakers, but in headphones, you're inside Tatum's head.
Oh, my goodness.
And you're hearing his decisions, why he accents notes, how he does runs, and you're hearing it all from his point of view. And it's just a spectacular audio experience.
And is that something that's going to be...
Yeah, so Sony, we did this on our first album by Glenn Gould. We did the same thing, and people just can't believe of mm-hmm. this experience of being able to be inside Glenn Gould's head and understand as a musician the decisions he's making.
Oh, how cool.
John Paul's just not along here because as a musician, this is just going to change everything. You know, picture being inside of Jimi Hendrix's head as he played and the decisions he makes.
And without drugs.
Right. You know, it's you're at a Beatles reunion, but you're inside of George Harrison's head and listen to it from his point of view.
Wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, John, now that we've laid out roughly how you accomplish all this, tell us a little bit about the Glenn Gould project. First of all, how did you settle on his recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations as your first major project?
He made this recording in 1955, and it was like that's almost the last year of mono before stereo.
Mm-hmm.
He was 22 years old. And he'd done a series of successful concerts in New York, and Columbia Records signed him up and said, hey, this guy's great.
He was quite the sensation in his day.
That's right. And they said, what do you want to record first? And as a classical pianist, it's normally you record a Beethoven sonata or a Chopin prelude, so, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I want to do this Bach Goldberg Variations. And it was generally thought it could not be played with two hands on one piano. It generally was thought you need, you know, like two manuals, you know, like in an organ or something like this to do it. And he said, no, I can do this. And over the course of several days at the age of 22, recorded this joyous, this amazing piano recording that has never gone out of print. You know, it's been on 8-track and cassette and every kind of thing over the years. It's one of the best selling commercial classical piano recordings ever.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But it's in mono.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in our discussions with Sony, they said this would be a good place to start. It also has another attribute. It's sold so many copies, and people know it so well, they've memorized all the notes.
Okay.
So we didn't really have to do this before and after. You know, here was before, as in, you know, we just did this Quarteau recording. Well, you may not know that one before.
Right.
But people who know this Gould is like, oh, yeah, we know, you know, 2 million people bought this.
So they could readily appreciate it.
Correct. And as musicians, you know, we have to get every note perfect. And were we to slip on any note, everyone would know it. And it was kind of the high wire walk for us. But mm-hmm. it was like, mm-hmm. no, we've got this process down.
Great.
And then lastly,
I understand the release has been very successful.
Yes. It was released in the U.S. around Memorial Day, and it's been on the Billboard Top 10 charts through most of the summer.
Terrific.
And again, most people look at it and go, this won't work until they listen to it, and then they melt.
Indeed.
And now you're going to get to listen to this.
Yeah, so we're going to start out with a little bit of the before again, mm-hmm. which John Paul is track 2,
mm-hmm.
and you can go ahead and let that roll. So you can actually hear the hiss from the LP, and it's a fairly modest recording in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Although obviously the performance is spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going to hear the Zempf Studios version re-performance mm-hmm. of Glenn Gould. Just remarkable, remarkable difference.
Thank you. Again, there's a whole team behind this, so you know, I'm just the radio voice here, but we've got a really spectacular team that puts this all together.
I'm sure you do. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about in terms of the team, you know, you've got all this extraordinarily high-tech hardware and innovative software that you've developed, But I'm sure at some point, artistic judgment still has to enter in. Where does that come in? And for example, what is the role of a producer in this type of process?
Oh, good. Okay, so Sony's producer, okay, is Steve Epstein, and he's won the Producer of the Year Grammy 5 times.
Wow.
So Sony didn't shrink when it came to this project.
They gave
project.
You the best.
And similarly with the recording engineer, Richard King, and I don't know how many Grammys he's won, but kind of some of the most famous recordings of the past 10 years, it's like, oh, Richard King was the engineer.
Mm-hmm.
The first time when we did this Gould, Steve Epstein had listened to the original recording extensively and had his score and had things kind of, you know, ready to check and whatever. And his job as the producer is to assure that everything's being played correctly. Now, normally that also involves, you know, making sure the performer...
Scream and yell at the talent.
Right. Has taken, you know, the actual artist has taken restroom breaks and, you know, it's like, come on, we got to take this take again. Well, we don't have those concerns because every take is the same. But actually it isn't, because the piano wears slightly and goes slightly out of tune or slight. And so one of the things we can do between takes is go, well, wait a minute, let's go back and adjust the piano a little bit and go back and do that take again. But what was funny in this first recording session for the Gould was Steve would go through his score and he'd mark a note. It was like, well, that note wasn't played correctly. And then everybody would stop. They go back to the original 1955 recording, listen to that same spot, and everybody go, oh, yeah, it was. Because what we had done is replicated, you know, not everything, let's try it again. We had replicated everything Gould had played, including all the flaws, you know, the gap, if he missed a note, if he brushed a note next to it. In fact, there's a spot in Variation 27 where it's surprising that this shipped, but Gould brushes a note. You know, he does a run and he comes down to the bottom of the running, hits the note next to it. And Steve, as our producer, stopped the recording session and said, "You don't have the wrong note right." and it was at that moment we had coded it correctly, but you know, in the humidity and the temperature and the wear and whatever in that room, that note wasn't sounding correctly. So this was one of the cases where we recoded it in software. And so the guys pulled out that measure, coded up 15 different ways that wrong note could be brushed. And then we all sat there with headphones and listened to dun da 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 dun da 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 boom, and there was the little, and listened to it 15 different ways. And everyone said, number 7, that's the right one. And so then we took the code for number 7, put that back in the original, and then we recorded the whole take again, and that's what you hear on the CD now.
Wow. So you had some very fine-tuned ears listening to all this.
Correct. I mean, you mentioned the artistic talent in this, that our lead musical researcher has 2 doctorates in music. And the other has a 1 doctorate. Our lead software engineer has a doctorate in programming, but he's a percussionist, a degree from Eastman.
Okay, yeah.
And it's been a good combination.
Excellent. So this has come out and is selling very well. And folks, if you are so inclined, you can go right out to the record store or Amazon or anywhere else.
That's
and
right.
Buy it right off the shelf.
Probably going to need to give them the search term, which is Zenph, is spelled Z-E-N-P-H.
Okay.
If you put that into Amazon, you'll get the right thing.
Terrific. John, I understand that when you demoed this for people in a live setting, and people who had been around Gould himself for many years, I understand they were completely blown away.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about Gould, which is, this is the anniversary of the 25th year of his death and the 75th year of his birth. So he died, in fact, when he was 50 years old, which was fairly young.
Sure.
A lot of the people who worked with him are still alive. His longtime tuner, his producers, and so on. And through a set of circumstances, we had the opportunity really early in this process to play this on a real instrument in Toronto.
And which is where he was.
I'm sorry, that was his hometown, perfectly.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I had been invited there to give a presentation to the Audio Engineering Society, the AES.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there prepared with, you know, a pretty deep discussion of recording technology. Well, it turns out the members of the Gould Foundation and the estate were in the back row of the audience. And we had a live piano there playing live, and they heard it, and they said, you know, we heard him play many times, that's him. But I didn't really find that out till some emails the next morning that said, we were in the back row of the audience, and I got to tell you, I've heard it a lot of times, but never like that.
Wow.
And at that point, they were very supportive in the process, and they continue to be just great friends to this project.
That must have been a moment of epiphany, almost.
Well, yeah.
We're doing the right thing.
And the other key step here is that Glenn Gould himself was a real leader in advancing recording technology.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that was one of my first questions that said, would he, you know, there's these things that are going to happen as part of our process. So part of it is the humming will tend to go away, and he tended to hum.
I was going to ask you about that. He had some tics that do show up
piano
on the
piano bench
recordings.
Tics and some other stuff like that. And I said, what's going to happen is those are going to go away. And it turns out he had tried all kinds of techniques to avoid this.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd set up baffles and walls and move the microphones and try all kinds of things to avoid the humming. And it still shows through at some extent. Some people love that. Some people hate it. At this point, we're not recreating the humming.
I see.
So you can hum along now if you choose. But we asked his longtime producer, you know, what would he have thought of this? And he said, John, if he'd had this technology, he would have used it in a second.
Sure, sure. Well, and in reading some of the materials, he early on retired from live performance to concentrate on recording, and he was probably the first artist to actually do that. The Beatles certainly did that in their day.
The same time frame.
And it's something I've certainly noted through the years is that some of the masterful musicians, we talked about Jimi Hendrix a little bit, and one of the things I always highly appreciated about him was the contributions he made to the recording process itself.
That's right.
Which is his studio is still thriving to this day, as a matter of fact.
Well, I like to think we're doing the same thing here, right, in Research Triangle Park.
Absolutely. My guest on Radio In Vivo, to remind everyone, is Dr. John Q. Walker, who is president of Zempf Studios in Raleigh. And, John, you mentioned earlier, and I'd like to get you to tell us a little bit more about it, that you're also doing a great deal of R&D to optimize the listening experience. Tell us a little bit more about that work.
Refresh me. We had a bit of discussion before we started here. So,
well, the fact that this can all be heard in various surround sound.
Oh, got it. Okay. So the point is the fact that what we hold is not the sound waves now. What we hold is the notes, the way to perform this all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm going to... when we think about music today, it's the notes and it's the way they're played. And the notes, you know, kind of exist in the score, but the way they're played is what's in the musician's head, and it's their whole lifetime of training and how to do this. And we see this transition coming that says in the future, it's not going to be the notes and how they're played, but it's going to be the data and the algorithms. And you can see that in just so many different fields where that's occurred over the years, but it's come very late to music. And the reason is our ears are so sensitive. They're so much more sensitive than our eyes. They work in three dimensions. They're incredibly wired to our memory and emotions. Not the same way our eyes are, in an odd sort of way. You get these odd goosebump reactions to listening to something that you don't normally have when you visually see it.
Sure.
And so it turns out that the audio domain of data and algorithms is much more demanding than the video domain. I came here to Chapel Hill to study these things, and when I was here, Chapel Hill really was the hotbed of research in computer video and computer graphics.
Mm-hmm,
it was kind of the best place in the world to do this. And so what we have is many ways to make new recordings again. And we talked about the fact that you can make them in surround sound, you can make them for headphones, you can make them stereo. We could go back and record with a gramophone again.
You know, John, many, many years ago I started looking at some research and some work that was done in what was called interaural cross-correlation theory. Is that kind of what you got into in order to get into this aspect of the listening environment?
People ask us about what techniques we're using, and I hate to say this, but we're using every single technique we can imagine, including the kitchen sink. So We use a lot of computer analysis. We've read every paper we can in the field. Mm-hmm. We talked about the fact that we've set up a lab. Well, part of that setting up the lab was for 2 years we did nothing but bring in live musicians to record what they did in microscopic detail, so we could go back in a way and build the equations for what it meant. What are the parameters of human performance?
Which involved the time of the arrival of the sound at either ear and how those those make for location and. Yeah,
we haven't exploited any of that, Jean-Paul, yet.
Oh, really?
But I think in the next, and in my timeline of technology, and in the next 4 or 5 years, you may not listen to a recording again per se. What you'll have is your little device, and it'll have it'll be iPod size, but it'll have 10 times the computer power,
mm-hmm.
and it will generate the performance on the spot. And acoustically,
sort of like MIDI does now.
Well, right. Acoustically, okay. In the space you want it to be, with the instruments you want it to be, and the style with the performers you want.
Wow.
And maybe in the mood you want. Or, mm-hmm. Maybe your favorite performer plays songs that they never recorded.
Yeah.
Or you wake up sad today and you want to hear your favorite song played sadder. And that's, again, a whole set of equations that we can work from once we've got data and algorithms.
Punch up the sad algorithm.
Well, right. It may be a little wheel again or something, but I think that, and maybe you trade these with your friends that says, oh, here's this style of playing, and I'll, listen to this.
That's going to be very exciting. Well, John, let's share some of the Art Tatum recording with the audience now.
All right, good.
And for those of you out there who may not be that familiar with jazz and the history of jazz, Art Tatum was one of the icons and real pioneers of jazz piano. And as John told us a little earlier, Zempf has created reperformances of some of Tatum's legendary recordings from 1933 and 1949. Before we hear the first track, John, was there a different set of challenges involved in recreating a jazz performance versus a classical one?
Good question. Part of the challenge in this one, and you just said it, which is there was recordings from two different time periods,
mm-hmm.
and actually he played in different styles, and that's readily apparent in the room. I didn't bring examples of that. I guess there's always the question in jazz of you don't have a score. You don't have the note per note, but that doesn't affect us. The scores for us are something that come out at the end.
Sure.
We can't rely on classical scores because Gould didn't always play what was in the score. And then he would do, trills and he'd leave out notes and whatever. And it's a nice kind of a benchmark, but the scores aren't particularly helpful.
And that's what makes a master musician a master musician, the ability to do that.
Right. They've learned it and then they're off on their own.
Mm-hmm. That's the artistry.
What you're going to hear here, and we'll play maybe the first 30 seconds and then fade of the before, is some material that was actually lost in the intervening 60 years. Sony currently has a CD of this performance,
mm-hmm.
and they had taken a 4-minute medley and took out 2 minutes of it. And we went back and found those original 2 minutes and put them back in the center of it. And I think that'll be a fun thing for people to listen to who are familiar even with the original CD now.
And is this the 1933 or the 1949?
This is a 1949. It's on a CD now, and I think it'll be called in the future, called Piano Starts Here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a Gershwin medley.
Okay.
And so you can start that off, and then we'll do the kind of a little bit before and after.
Okay.
Just so you know, when you get to the after, it's not the new one we recorded in the Shrine a few weeks ago.
Okay.
Because we don't have those released from Sony yet.
Okay.
So this will be the
acoustic.
Stay
tuned for that.
Yeah, this will be what we did in our own lab here in Raleigh.
I see. Okay, so what we're about to hear is going to be the Art Tatum track. And this is going to be, we're going to start you out again with the before.
And this
version.
Is real rough. It's best you can know. You can hear what we work from.
And that's track one on the Tatum CD.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the before. All right. Well, we're having our own little technical challenges here. We should have done this show from your studio, perhaps.
This is it. It sounds, it's really rough. You hear screaming? I think that's part of the recording.
Oh, okay, here it comes.
Yeah.
You want to boost your level a little bit.
This It may be unplayable to people. You can fade it out and just do the transition to the next track. Yeah, that was it.
Yeah,
that,
okay.
That's what we had to work from. It was a really old reel-to-reel tape. You can barely hear it.
Yeah.
But wait till you hear what he's playing. And let's try the next track. That was it. That's where the cut had occurred, so this is the part no one's heard.
Okay. And this is beautiful. John, that is just remarkable. You can leave that under, John Paul. We'll talk over a little bit. That's Art Tatum, or the re-performance.
Recorded in Raleigh. That's recorded, not the one recorded in the Shrine yet. So wait
right
a few more weeks for that. Yeah.
Well, you can really hear the genius shining
through.
That's
the point. And lots of kids, and I'll say that specifically, haven't heard Art Tatum play.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we'll go to a convention or show or something. We'll have a live piano. And again, Art Tatum died the year before stereo. And it's not on iPods much, and it's just not heard. And they just will jump up and down and say, play it again, because they've never heard it playing like this.
Absolutely.
You know, I just thought of something. What, what if you were able to sync this up with actual film of performance?
You bet. Wow. Absolutely no problem.
Would be cool.
Yes. So expect that tour next year.
Okay. Excellent. Well, John, in our communication and preparation for the show today, you anticipated a question I was going to ask about whether this is strictly applicable to piano or whether you're also developing it for other instruments as well. And I understand that you have brought us a demo of a re-performance on string bass that you wanted to share with us. And John Paul, you can go ahead and cue that up and let us know when you're ready.
Sure.
And that this is actually going to be the first time it's ever been heard on the radio.
So let me tell you, it's hard to describe this to musicians that says, at this point, it's only 99% perfected. It's not quite 100%. So I'm going to give you the caveat.
Okay.
On the other hand, it'll give you goosebumps. But this is one of the, it's not ready to record yet. It's not ready to ship. But we've realized that we can cross over into the next instrument. So we spent the past couple months understanding what it meant to be a string bass player. And, you know, every fingernail and every pluck and every twist of a note And what you're going to hear is a recording of the Oscar Peterson Trio, made in 1961. Very famous bass excerpt in Kadota's Blues.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to hear, first of all, the trio, just about a minute of it, or, you know, we can just, whatever. And then what you'll hear in one ear on the next, you know, before and after will be, before will be the whole trio.
Mm-hmm.
And the second time will be the trio in one ear, solo bass in the other. And this was not made from having separate tracks. This was, we extracted the bass line. And then if we get a chance, we'll play the bass line all by itself.
Okay, well, let's hear the before. This is the mm-hmm. Oscar Peterson Trio with Ray Brown on bass.
That's right.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and cue up the next track,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, from 1961, you know, that it sounds compressed.
Yeah.
It's mono.
It's a live audience,
you know,
yeah, right.
So, you know, not quite as bad as the
nope.
1926 thing, but certainly worthy of being reperformed, as you've done. And so the next track we're going to hear is...
The same the thing.
Same thing, but with the reperformance.
And in one ear.
In one
in
ear.
The right ear. And in the other ear will be the trio. Playing at the same time. How about that?
Wow.
Hear they're dead in sync.
And such a rich sound from that bass.
Right. From our new software-only bass. Tuning, the whole bit.
Sound like a software bass.
I understand.
Yeah.
You're hearing the best in the world here. Now, if you want to hear it all by itself, it'd be the next track.
Let's cue that up and hit the next track. And this is just the bass as
just the bass
as reperformed by Zenth. Here again, the artistry just absolutely shines through.
It has to be that human, that day in that room. And if we haven't done that, we haven't done the service to Ray Brown. We can't go, oh, here's a pretty good representation of, no, that's Ray Brown that day.
Now, I'm going to show my ignorance. Is Ray Brown still with us?
I'm afraid he isn't.
He isn't. Okay. Well, it'll be interesting to see what... When you do a reperformance of someone who is, and
well,
they can actually
hear themselves. We went to Oscar Peterson's living room this past March, and Oscar is still alive, and
okay.
We spent an afternoon doing Art Tatum and Oscar Peterson for Oscar Peterson.
Oh, that must have been great fun. Well, John, I'm sure this is, as you've described, just frighteningly complex work. But eventually, as you and your team keep at it,
mm-hmm.
You're going to have an enormous amount of firepower available. Do you think you'll eventually expand this to include reperformances of entire ensembles
yes.
as opposed to a solo instrument? Is
yes.
that kind of the holy grail of all this?
It's all of music. You know, mm-hmm. we will do bands and orchestras and choirs and so on. And it's a matter of digital processing and understanding and algorithms and data, and it all lays before us. And welcome to the 21st century.
Yeah, absolutely. So, what's next for Zenth? Where are you going with your R&D?
Well, we've got some time here.
Yeah.
One example we've done here is a wax cylinder from 1903.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to go way far back. This is a Spanish composer named Itzhak Albéniz.
Okay.
And for us, it was a chance to see how far we could push our technology. Well, the answer is we found out the answer, which is we couldn't figure out some of the things going on in this recording.
Mm-hmm.
We could hear overtones, but we couldn't figure out the exact notes were made. So we did a different process, which is we created the score for this the first time rather than going straight to the computer notes.
Okay.
And we created the score because the world's expert at Albanus piano music lives here in Raleigh.
How
Professor
nice.
Milton Laufer at Peace College. And so we were able to bring in academic and go, yep, those are the notes, and listen to them. And so what I'm going to play is a little bit of this wax cylinder and then Dr. Laufer playing from the score.
Okay, okay.
From 1903.
Great. And this is... Now that's rough.
Yeah, that's rough.
Okay.
That's wax.
That's wax. So let's go ahead and hear a little bit of the recreation of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is... Oh, my goodness.
Wow.
It's like putting on glasses for the first time.
That's unbelievable.
And this is our only evidence of how this very influential composer played. He made three wax cylinders. And here's your only chance to hear him.
Well, John, very, very briefly, because we are just about out of time, what is the business model as Zenf moves forward? What's your plan for world domination here?
Well, it's a matter of, again, data and algorithms, and we need to, you know, we want to own a lot of the data and the algorithms for understanding that. Our first set of contracts is with Sony and Yamaha, where we're making new recordings or we're making new files to play on their instruments. We'll have a contract next few weeks with Boosey and Hawks, I think, to do the Tatum scores and definitive scores.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, you know, we'll be building software for studios and everything kind of involved with the new recording industry here.
Terrific. Well, John Walker, it's been absolutely fascinating to hear all about this incredible work you're doing at Zenf Studios. And we are very proud to have you in the Triangle and wish you the best of success as you build the Zenf empire.
Ernie, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Well, before you go, I want to thank John Paul McClellan for running the board for me today and helping us spin the stacks of wax and mounds of sound. We've got some terrific guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. And in fact, we will have another exploration of music next week. So you can check the website, radioinvivo.net, and we update that regularly. So join us again next time. For Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro, and Chapel Hill.